From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour, a conversation with investigative writer and activist John Stauber. Stauber founded the nonprofit, nonpartisan Center for Media and Democracy. He'll tell us about the impact of the flood of anonymous corporate money in this election and how government and industry organize public relations campaigns to manage our attitudes, perceptions, and behavior. Then, Iowa State University psychology professor Douglas Gentile. He'll tell us about the U.S. Supreme Court case brought by the state of California against the video game industry. The case concerns a proposed law to prohibit the sale of violent video games to minors without parental consent. That's all coming up this hour. First, the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is John Stauber. In 1993, John Stauber founded the nonprofit, nonpartisan Center for Media and Democracy and its magazine PR Watch in Madison, Wisconsin. In 2009, he stepped down from that position after 16 years. Today, he is an independent investigative writer, activist, and a consultant to public interest organizations, including the Food Rights Network. John Stauber has authored 6 books, including his 1995 work, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, and the 2003 New York Times bestseller, Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War on Iraq. John Stauber will be speaking at the University of Northern Iowa next Monday, November 8th, in Lang Hall Auditorium. That's at 7:30 p.m. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you, Ben.
Where was public relations at work in this midterm election?
Probably the biggest storyline on this historic election that saw, you know, a overwhelming return to power in the Congress for the Republican right began months ago when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the Citizens United case that corporations would essentially be able to spend unlimited amounts of money influencing elections. And so what we saw in the midterm election was billions, with a B, billions of dollars pouring into the creation and funding of what I call front groups. Public relations experts created these groups with interesting sounding names that received billions of anonymous dollars and coordinated their attack to knock out Democratic candidates.
Mm-hmm. Can you point to any specific races that where this big money poured into it and the money, the anonymous money, corporate money, was either successful or not successful? There in Wisconsin, Russ Feingold lost his seat.
Senator Feingold was first elected to the Senate 18 years ago. He's doesn't have big money. He's not a millionaire. He's a guy who grew up in Janesville, a real regular Joe, if you will. Ron Johnson, who's the senator-elect now from Wisconsin, was a millionaire himself. He married into money, and he runs businesses, and he put something like $10 million into his own campaign. But what really dominated the airwaves were attack ads from a myriad of organizations. And to be honest, Ben, I couldn't even give you the name of one of these organizations, and their names don't really matter because, again, of these attack ads being sponsored by nonprofits who are not required to reveal who puts the money into them. And because of the Supreme Court ruling that unleashed this mechanism, the ads that just dominated the airwaves and made Senator Feingold look like nobody you'd want to be seen with anywhere at any time in your life were, I think, extremely successful in mobilizing an alienated and angry electorate who understandably is quite fed up with the people in power and ready to throw the bums out and toss the new bums in.
In Iowa, a lot of anonymous corporate money was spent to try and defeat incumbent Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley of Iowa's 1st District. more money was spent into the name of the American Futures Fund than by either the Braley or his opponent, Ben Lange's, campaigns. Now, Ben Lange didn't have to defend the attack ads. He could say, I have nothing to do with them. So that's another dimension, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of like you show up for a football game, your junior high against their junior high, and in walks Aaron Rodgers or Brett Favre to play quarterback for your team, and you go, hey, I didn't invite him here, he just showed up. You know, and believe me, that's very, you know, legally the law says that these anonymously funded attack groups cannot coordinate with the candidates. Now, we know who funds them. We know the stereotype. It's incredibly wealthy billionaire individuals like the Koch brothers.
How do we know that? If you said at the beginning of this conversation, we will never know the source of this money, and now you're telling me the source of this money.
Well, we'll never know the specific source. That ad that runs attacking Russ Feingold from the American Futures Fund, obviously there are people identified with the fund, there are executive directors, there are campaign consultants, and we know that this has been a very successful formula. On the right, Sheldon Rampton and I wrote a book some years ago titled Banana Republicans, looking at how business interests, the Chamber of Commerce, multinational corporations, individual right-wing donors from the Koch family and the Scaife family have prided themselves on creating think tanks and front groups. So we know the broad picture. But when suddenly one of these organizations pops up and spends hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars running attack ads in a campaign, there is now no requirement, if they're set up as a nonprofit, that that particular funding be revealed. It might be just one very wealthy person who writes out a $5 million check to start a front group and says, go get that guy.
Now, you say very successful, this anonymous corporate money funneling into this campaign in a new way for the first time, but not always successful. We can point to Bruce Braley by the slimmest of margins, holding on to his seats in the first district. I wonder, do you think that when the campaign targeted by the anonymous money effectively gets the word out that a lot of anonymous corporate money is being used to attack them, it can have the opposite effect, inspiring many people to be uneasy who is behind this money and to vote against the big anonymous money?
Well, I'd like to think that. I'd like to think that this corruption of our electoral system, whereby the most powerful electoral tool ever invented, TV advertising, can be used by wealthy special interests to run scurrilous attacks, and they often are. I would like to think that the typical American voter, whether they're left, right, independent, Republican, Democrat, Green, is offended by this takeover of the campaigning process. I'm not sure that that's the case. I think what happens is because both sides now run attack ads, if you're attacked, your advertising tends to turn to attack ads on your candidate. There are organizations like Move On and the labor unions that fund similar organizations attacking Republican candidates. I think what happens most for the potential voter is they just become disgusted, they tune out, and in many cases, what they want to do is just keep you from the polls. They want you to feel negatively enough about a candidate or the process that you'll stay at home. And we saw one front group running ads aimed at depressing the turnout of Hispanic voters to hurt Democrats who would be the normal recipients of that vote. So the whole process has become so ugly, and I think most of your listeners would agree with that. But it's unclear what, if anything, is going to change. In fact, I would say that It's now gone to a whole new level in this campaign, and that from here on out it's only going to get worse. And the politicians who end up in office and are the ones we citizens might implore to please bring some civility and some transparency and responsibility back to this whole electoral process have been put in place by the increase in corruption. So it's an ugly cycle that reinforces the worst trends in our political process right now.
John Stauber is my guest, the founder of the nonprofit Nonpartisan Center for Media and Democracy. And today he is an independent investigative writer, activist, and consultant to public interest organizations. John Stauber, let's broaden this out beyond the realm of politics to talk about what you point to as the influence of unethical public relations practices, not just in politics, but throughout our society. Explain your overarching concerns about how PR functions in our society.
Public relations is a euphemism. It actually is a word invented by a gentleman by the name of Eddie Bernays, who was a nephew of Sigmund Freud, essentially took the psychological insights that Freud was exploring and used them to develop ways of manipulating public perception and opinion in an invisible way so that people weren't aware of how they were being manipulated. And that's essentially the essence of all good propaganda. You know, if you know that there's a campaign out there targeted at you to try to get you to perceive an issue or an individual or a candidate or a product in a certain way, then, as we were talking about earlier in the political arena, you might have some abhorrence. You might be quite offended that somebody's trying to manipulate your opinion. So it's very important that this propaganda be invisible. And that was the beginning of the public relations industry. Today, the public relations industry is a massive global industry. The big companies tend to be owned by the advertising firms, and every wealthy individual, politician, corporation uses hidden propaganda techniques to manage what they call public perception, to affect policy, whether it's policy debates around issues of global climate change or free trade, or whether, as we've been talking, it's the packaging and management of political campaigns.
In 2003, John Stauber, you co-wrote Weapons of Mass Deception, the Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War on Iraq, the title of that book, in which you argued that the Bush administration deceived the American public into supporting the war. Now, in 2006, you co-wrote a follow-up, The Best War Ever, Lies, Damned Lies, and the Mess in Iraq. I'm wondering now, with the Iraq war winding down and Afghanistan having wound up, how would you evaluate the Obama administration in its truthfulness?
I think Obama has two huge problems on his hand. One is, he claims to have wound down and successfully concluded the war in Iraq, but the reality is that there are 50,000 U.S. troops there, tens of thousands of contractors. The situation in Iraq is as volatile as ever. Just yesterday, over 100 people were killed in coordinated bombings in Iraq. That could flare back up at any time, and I don't see those 50,000 troops actually leaving that country anytime soon. So this idea that peace is at hand in Iraq, I think, is a political spin from the Obama administration. On the other hand, he campaigned and was elected as a candidate who would ratchet up the war in Afghanistan. He's done that. The problem is Afghanistan now has dragged on for 9 years, no end in sight. And again, the U.S. is losing control of the situation. No president wants to lose a war on his watch. And so, you know, I'm old enough to remember it, Vietnam, where we now know that three presidents kept that war going primarily to protect their own prestige and their self-image as not going to lose a war on their watch. I think Obama's in the same situation. So again, propaganda and spin and political spin around these two wars are going to be huge issues in the 2012 election, no matter what shape the economy's in, because these wars are dragging on and dragging on.
John, you are also a consultant to public interest organizations, including the Food Rights Network. This past summer, 500 million eggs were recalled from Iowa producers, that on the heels of a national salmonella outbreak that sickened hundreds from coast to coast. Did you look into the role PR played in the way we saw this salmonella outbreak?
Well, I've written about food safety issues. I wrote with Sheldon Rampton a book in 1997 that accurately predicted that mad cow disease would be discovered in the U.S. because the PR campaign coming out of the USDA and the corporation said we've done the right thing, when the reality was they didn't. And this is sort of the recurring PR theme with these industrial agriculture disasters where people will be sickened, people die, there's an uproar, the government and industry sort of rally around, they hold hearings, they swear up and down the problem is going to be fixed, and everyone sort of stops looking at that, and the problems don't get fixed. And I think this is endemic in our politics, where these big interests, whether it's the oil companies or the factory egg farms, ultimately win the day in Washington. So PR, yeah, it plays a role in all this, where we're told, hey, don't worry, since the last outbreak, we've fixed things. And then the next outbreak rolls around, and it's like that movie Groundhog Day, except people are dead.
How do we know that these entities haven't seen the light, that BP hasn't turned the corner as a corporate identity to become more environmentally friendly? Aren't these just kind of normal corrections that will happen when people get lax?
Well, maybe in the little town I grew up in 50 years ago, if it involved the store down the street. But when you're talking about these giant transnational corporations, they live from quarter to quarter. It's all bottom line. They're going to get away with anything they can get away with. People often say, oh, look what Chevron did in Ecuador. Look what Shell did in Nigeria. That could never happen here. Well, they'll get away with anything they can get away with, and they get away with as much as they can in this country. And as we've started the conversation, this is who is determining the outcomes of our elections. So the political will in Washington to actually put in place regulations that force corporations to do what they need to do to be responsible isn't there. And corporations themselves are spending massive amounts on PR telling us they're doing the right thing. The irony with BP, of course, is that BP literally spent hundreds of millions of dollars rebranding itself, saying that BP now stood for Beyond Petroleum. And a lot of people, it worked. A lot of people actually bought gas from BP for years because they saw the ads where BP said they were an environmentally responsible oil company. But we now know that they're just like all the others. And the only thing that made them stand out was the degree to which they were willing to deceive us through their public relations campaigns.
You pointed to the media's role in this earlier on. Of course, much of the public relations is given to us after being distributed by media. When you look at our media landscape, the news media landscape, are the media, the news media, up to the task to be critical enough in consuming and passing on this public relations?
No, absolutely not. I mean, journalism is in severe demise. And I would say that the best journalists in America now work for the public relations industry. The fact is that for decades now, there have been more people with journalism backgrounds and educations employed by PR firms manipulating and managing public opinion and the media than there are journalists employed by news organizations. You know, it's journalists who are creating the public relations information former journalist now working in PR, and then it's journalists still in the news business, unethically, in my opinion, passing that on as their own reporting. It's hard to overstate what a bad state journalism is in. And again, I hate to be, the bearer of bad news, but this seems to be only getting worse. And most Americans get most of their news from television. We know from a number of stories that in the case of war, for instance, it tends to be that the more TV war coverage you watch, the less you actually know factually about that war, but the more likely you are to support the government's position on it. So The problem here comes down to critical thinking, the ability of each of us to separate the wheat from the chaff, to take this information overflow that's coming to us and figure out what's reality, what are the facts, what do we need to do about it.
That being said, what can we as individuals do to not be duped? We all have our lives, our jobs, and then to ask us to see through a veil of PR that is presented in our news sources, that's a tall order.
Yeah, it's a tremendously tall order, and it requires us to be active in figuring things out. But that's what we have to do, and that's always the challenge in a democracy. The ideal and idea behind democracy is that we, the average people, can actually figure out what's best for us and how to run our lives, and we can elect people to government who respond to our own decision-making. Perhaps we've reached a point where the propaganda is so overwhelming and so sophisticated, and it's coming to us through our TVs and the Internet and the radio, that we just can't figure it out anymore. That would be a sad day, but the reality is that most of the information we get is the part of a corporate or government PR or marketing campaign.
I'm not very hopeful when I hear your words.
No, and I think hope is a term that has really become a buzzword for PR, whether it's political or corporate PR. I've never been a very hopeful person. I try to be realistic.
In the PR world, you can surely point to examples where public relations has been used for a larger good.
Oh, yeah. And, often public relations professionals who, do hone to ethical standards and do work, for instance, confronting the tobacco industry with anti-smoking PR to save people's lives, will say, hey, the industry's not all bad and evil. What I say is, well, but it's all propaganda. In a democracy, the most important thing is that we learn to think critically, and if we're going to make a decision, not be manipulated into it.
John Stauber, I want to thank you very much for this conversation.
Sure. Thank you, Ben.
John Stauber is an independent investigative writer, activist, and consultant to public interest organizations. He is the founder of the nonprofit Nonpartisan Center for Media and Democracy and its magazine PR Watch in Madison, Wisconsin. John Stauber will be speaking at the University of Northern Iowa next Monday, November 8th, in Lang Hall Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Video games and violence in the news again. Earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments about a California law which prohibits the sale of violent video games to minors without parental consent. The video game industry is arguing prohibiting the sale of video games is a violation of the First Amendment's protection of free speech. Joining me now to discuss the case and research on the effects of violent video games, Douglas Gentile, a research scientist, author, award-winning educator, also associate professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. He is the editor of the book Media Violence in Children and co-author of the book from 2007, Violent Video Game Effects on Children and Adolescents. His research has been referenced in the U.S. Supreme Court case. Douglas Gentile, welcome to our program once again. Nice to have you back.
Oh, glad to be back. Thanks, Ben.
Clarify your role in this case, this U.S. Supreme Court case, some of your research there at ISU being brought up in the case.
Yes, that's really mainly the only role that I've played in this, is that a lot of the research that has been done at Iowa State by myself and Craig Anderson and previously Brad Bushman, a lot of that is some of the seminal research that will be looked at in trying to determine, you know, is this even something that the court should be concerned about? That's certainly separate from the First Amendment issue, but just, you know, is there even any case that there can be harm from violent video gameplay? Mm-hmm.
The California law would impose a $1,000 fine on stores that sell violent video games to people under 18, and it defines games as, quote, those games in which a range of options available to a player includes killing, maiming, dismembering, or sexually assaulting an image of a human being in a way that is patently offensive, appeals to minors' deviant or morbid interests, and lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. In your opinion, how many popular video computer games would qualify as violent under this definition?
Well, I think there are plenty that probably would qualify under that definition. But of course, that definition is going to be one of the major sticking points about, you know, where are the limits of this legislation? Is that definition clear enough that people generally would agree on it? And I think that's an open question, whether or not it is. It's certainly a different definition than researchers used.
Mm.
And so when we're talking about media violence, generally we're looking at a broader spectrum of aggressive acts which are defined based on intentional harm, which is the way we would define aggression in human relations. If I intentionally harm you, then I'm being aggressive. Now, I could do that through verbal, or I could do that through relational ways, or I could do it through physical ways. So this is trying to really nail down a very specific type of action, and I think it's worded in the way that many of the pornography laws are. And so I think that's part of why it's defined that way.
I want to throw out some names of some computer games just so people know. They may have these in their homes. Their teens may be playing these, but
sure.
Halo, Gears of War, Call of Duty, Grand Theft Auto, these are all ones that would come into question, right?
I don't think Halo would, because most of the fighting in there is against space aliens.
Oh.
But certainly Grand Theft Auto, Call of Duty, which is a war game, Grand Theft Auto, you get to play a criminal sociopath and basically shoot anyone you want to. And certainly those would count. And those already have a mature label from the video game industry. So, and many stores already have policies saying they won't sell mature-rated games to kids under 17. The problem is, and the reason I think there was this impetus for this law, is that even though the industry does label their games, the labels aren't always all that accurate. And secondly, even though stores have policies saying they won't sell these games to minors, in studies that I've done where I send kids as young as 7 in with $50 to go and see if they can go buy a mature-rated game, it usually only takes them 2 attempts. 1 out of every 2 times, they walk out no questions asked. So I think this law stems from parents wanting a little more support than they're actually getting at this point.
So it's a law currently with no teeth in Iowa, for example.
It's not a law at all. It's totally voluntary. All of the media ratings, television, movies, video games, they're totally voluntary, including at the theater. The theater chooses to try to keep your kid out of an R-rated film, but they don't have to. And there's no penalty if they don't.
Mm.
And many adults don't realize that. They assume that these are actually legislated, but they haven't been. And this is one of the first attempts to legislate that there is a rating that is taken seriously.
I want to reach out to our Exchange listeners and ask, are you a gamer or a parent, a concerned parent with an opinion about whether the sale of violent video games to minors without parental consent should be prohibited? Is the California law a violation of free speech, or is it good common sense law? Perhaps you're a parent with concerns about the effects of these games and have a story to tell from your home. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Now, Douglas Gentile, if you just joined us, our guest, research scientist, award-winning educator, author, associate professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. Those arguing the case before the Supreme Court have tried analogies to books, films, cartoons, comic books, fairy tales, even rap lyrics. They argued about what the drafters of the Bill of Rights would have made of extremely violent games. Here's an example that I think has been brought up this week at the Supreme Court. The game is called Postal 2. A warning here. This is an extreme video game. Postal 2, a game in which gamers, and these are the words of a reviewer, control a crazed protagonist as he murders and mutilates his way through everyday situations. Gamers can make the protagonist, known as Postal Dude, shoot, behead, and urinate on other characters. Here's a little bit of audio from Postal 2.
That can't be good. That's the one. Yeah, that's what they all say.
So tell me, Douglas Gentile, this is the worst of violent video games, what they're offering right now, hopefully, isn't it?
Actually, that's an old game at this point, and there are others. And by worst, I guess, you know, that's a fairly value-laden question, but one that probably people would claim really is the current worst is one called Rape Play, where you can actually rape various women and then force them to have an abortion. And
oh my God! Why do we even need science to tell us this is bad for us?
Well, I think because people can honestly say, you know, I played lots of these violent games and I never shot anyone. And the science helps us to understand, well, there are lots of other ways these games could have effects besides the most extreme things, such as, you know, actually going out and trying to shoot someone. And so the science helps to show what is affected when kids play these types of games. And we've learned that there are a number of cognitive level variables. They start having more accepting beliefs about how okay it is to be aggressive. They start perceiving the world in more terms of hostility. So then when they get bumped in the hallway, they stop assuming it was an accident. They start assuming it had hostile intent. Starting to understand really what are the psychological dimensions on which these games have effects that ultimately might result in kids starting to behave a little more aggressively.
So how valid is the argument that violent video games spur violent behavior in real life?
Well, I think if we're talking about violent behavior, which is very extreme criminal, then I think violent video games really are not a major cause. They are one risk factor among many. And so if we look at, say, some of the school shooters, no one thing causes such an extreme event. What it requires is multiple risk factors. So like the killers at Columbine had uninvolved parents, they had psychiatric illnesses, they had been bullied, and they played a lot of violent video games. There's kind of the recipe for violent behavior when you have many risk factors and very few protective factors.
So you've got an aggressive person to begin with from the personality from the get-go, and that person gravitates towards extremely aggressive computer games, and that makes that person even more aggressive and desensitized. Is that
that is what we're finding in the research, that yes, in fact, over time, the more you play these games, the more aggressive you do become. And that's true not only for the kids who start out being aggressive, but it also seems to be true for kids who didn't start out being aggressive. It's kind of, and it makes sense, actually, because what's happening is learning. And kids learn the same way, whether or not they're boys or girls, whether or not they're already aggressive.
Let's go to Larry in Webster City. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Email theexchange at iowapublicradio.org. Larry, welcome to our program. What are your thoughts when you hear this conversation?
Well, I have 2 points to make. One, I'm a gamer. My 9-year-old son's a gamer, and I flat out don't allow him to buy any kind of game that's overly violent. I think the most violent thing he plays is Zelda, and you're basically feeding on monsters and that. But I guess my first point is, and your guest made mention of this. If your parents are not involved, it doesn't make any difference whether or not they can buy the games at the store or not.
Hmm.
They will get them one way or another, or
right.
they will play them one way or another. And I think trying to make it a legal issue just absolves a lot of parents from their own responsibility to monitor what their kids are doing. The second thing is, and I think we've seen the same pattern happen the last 5 or 6 decades. In the 50s, it was the comic books, and everybody was up in arms about the comic books making our kids violent, et cetera, et cetera. And then that kind of went away, and then the movies, and then we went to video games, and it's just they always find or music, and they always find one more thing that they're going to be all up in arms about, and then try to impose some kind of legal solution, and it just doesn't work in the end because people are going to do things that we don't all want them to do, regardless. And I think trying to censor people is not the way to go about it.
Okay,
and
Larry,
thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry, calling from Webster City. Let's take his points perhaps in reverse order. The first one, how, if at all, is playing a violent video game different from watching a violent movie or reading a violent comic book?
And this is actually where the science is very useful. He makes an excellent point that, you know, with each new medium, parents and lawmakers often do react perhaps overly strongly to it, partly because it's just new and they don't understand it like the new generation does. But the science does make it clear not all of these types of media have the same effects. For example, the research on violent music is much weaker than the research on violent television or movies or video games. And also the research on violent books and comic books is also much weaker. So certain types of media do seem to have stronger effects and are more concerning than others.
Mm. So some computer games we know for younger people, that was mentioned, I think Zelda, was that the name of the game, also have violence of a more benign nature. You can wield a cartoon hammer to bonk or squash your opponents. No blood, no decapitation, similar to acting out in a Warner Brothers cartoon. How much, Douglas Gentile, does the realism of the violence, which is very real in today's virtual games, make a difference?
Well, it's a great question. There is not much research on it. There's only one study that I know of that even starts to address that question, and it's one that Craig Anderson here at Iowa State and I published, where we had elementary school age kids and college students play a violent or nonviolent game. In one case, they were these cartoonish kind of everyone rated games where no one really dies. You're shooting a ray gun at people or things like that, and they just disappear. And for the adults, we also have them play teen-rated fighting games, so those are ones where there's not much blood. And in other studies, we've had them play the mature-rated, really violent, bloody ones and realistic. And what we find is about the same size effect on willingness to behave aggressively immediately after playing. Now, what we don't know is, is that the same thing as a long-term effect? Would we find the same thing if we looked longitudinally? So there's only one study of this type. It seems that what mattered, at least in this study, is that you're practicing behaving aggressively. You're practicing intentional harm against other characters, and that seems to matter more than the blood.
Okay. Very quickly, we want to get to a couple other callers, but don't want to forget the caller from Webster City mentioning the role of parental responsibility. Does your science address that?
Oh, yes. And he's exactly right. What we find in our studies almost every time is not only does media violence consumption matter, but parental monitoring and setting limits matters greatly too. When parents set limits on how much time their kids are in front of screens and what the content is, that's a powerful protective factor for kids. Those kids are getting better grades. Those kids are getting into fewer fights in school.
Okay, as a parent, what kind of behavior have you linked to violent video games in your home? 1-866-780-9100. Are you a gamer, a concerned parent? Let's hear from you. Shane is in Northwest Iowa. Shane, good afternoon. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much. Love your program. I'm a Army vet, and I'm a gamer. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2. It has a controversial part of the game that lets your character is an undercover U.S. Soldier with terrorists, and as they go through the airport, they start killing civilians, hundreds and hundreds of civilians. And you can turn off the controversial part of that, but you cannot choose to help the civilians. You either follow along blindly behind these guys, watching them kill. You can also kill, but if you try to attack the terrorists, they turn on you and kill you.
So you have to be a terrorist, or at least a passively watching with the terrorists.
Right, right. They force you into it, and I think that's wrong. I think that's over the top, where they're actually pushing them into, you know, into a certain mold that they want them to be. And I thought I'd like to hear your guests' comments on that.
Shane, what a good example. Thank you very much, Shane from Northwest
Thank
Iowa.
You.
How do we know this? I mean, how can science decide what is, and I think Justice Antonin Scalia asked this in a pointed question, what's the difference between a deviant violent video game and a normal violent video game?
And right now, science has not got a good answer to that. We have some ideas what it would be likely to be. That we certainly know from years of research on television violence that, first of all, you know, realism should matter, that how much you identify with the violent character matters. But also, one of the things that's happening as you're watching or playing along is you are imagining it along with it. And as you practice that way of thinking, that, of course, is, you know, one of the ways we learn to think. Is we fantasize about things. We imagine things. And as anyone who has ever spent a lot of time fantasizing about anything knows, it does change the way you think the more you do it. So that's the concern, is that if we start having lots of games where you are practicing really deviant ways of thinking, that could change the way kids think. And, of course, thinking is related to later behaviors. Mm-hmm. But there isn't any good science on it showing that's really what happens yet.
Let's go to Chris quickly in Pella before our hour ends. Chris, good afternoon. Welcome to The Exchange.
Afternoon.
Yes, go ahead quickly. We have just a couple minutes.
Okay. I'm a gamer. I'm a parent. I believe it is 100% the responsibility of the parents to manage what their kids play, do, and entertain. I myself play video games, but I have a 5-year-old and 3-year-old that are nowhere present or capable of hearing the games like Counter-Strike and Call of Duty that I do like to play. And I use ratings near 100% unless I visually see that it's otherwise for video games, movies, whatever the case is.
Okay. Chris, thank you for that opinion from Pella. And I want to close out by you have written, Douglas Gentile, in an opinion piece that it was disturbing to you that people assume that scientists who conduct research on video games are somehow biased and are trying to prove a position or another. Now, have you ever been verbally attacked for your research on this issue?
Oh, yeah. And I, in fact, I've gotten death threats.
You've gotten death threats? On what basis?
You know, it's often, you know, people who love violent games who say, I play these violent games forever and they don't make me violent, so I'm going to come right over there and kill you, which is
ironic. It really proves the point, doesn't it?
Well, you know, I don't know that I'd count it as good evidence, but it is the case that that many people assume that, you know, based on the type of research a scientist does, that somehow suggests that they're, you know, they're trying to find a certain thing. You know, I would much rather find that violent games have no effect, but that's just not what I find. And when I do studies showing the positive effects of games, such as when you play pro-social games, kids actually become more helpful and cooperative. You know, it's the same effect from my standpoint. We learn whatever we do. Whatever we practice, we get better at. And that really shouldn't be a surprise.
Right. It sounds like so much common sense that science is just weighing in on and coming up with common sense answers.
Well, you know, sometimes we come up with common sense answers. Sometimes we come up with surprises. But really, I can't ever know until I do the study.
Quickly, in just a few seconds, what's the next step for you, Douglas Gentile? What are you working on?
Well, I think one of the next steps around this would be to get a real dialogue in the country going about why are the ratings on media products so bad that parents don't usually use them. You know, we hear some parents use them very well, but even when they are used regularly, many of the ratings have a number of problems, so you still would have your kids exposed to things you didn't expect them to be. And so I'd like to actually see us put more effort into improving the rating systems rather than necessarily spending all of our time talking about access restriction.
Douglas Gentile, thank you very much for being on the program. Always a pleasure to have you with us.
It's my pleasure. And if anyone wants to read some of the studies, they can go out to my public website, which is www.drdouglas.org.
Okay, Douglas Gentile of Iowa State University. And we want to go out with a little different music, classic fighting video game music from Mortal Kombat, first released in 1992. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.